Ready?
Yep, ready.
Good morning. My name is Owen Egan, and I am the chairman of the Freedom of Information Commission. This is the special meeting of the commission, November 23rd, 2022. The public may listen to the meeting in real time by following the instructions listed at the top of the commission's agenda currently posted on the commission's website. The meeting is being recorded in its entirety. A copy of the recording will be made available on the commission's website. For the benefit of the public, particularly those individuals who may be listening by telephone, I will call the roll of the commissioners for each vote today so that the record will reflect the votes of the individual commissioners. I will now call the roll of the commissioners who are present. Commissioner Barry. Commissioner Einhorn.
Here.
Commissioner Fuseschi.
Here.
Commissioner Hankins.
Here.
Commissioner Streeter.
Here.
And myself, Owen Egan, present. There is only one item on the commission's agenda today. I will call it PRVR number 4, City of Stamford versus Matthew J. Olson. Before we consider this matter, I will ask the commission counsel, Mary Schwinn, to please make the usual announcements.
Thank you, Commissioner. As the commissioner stated, the entire matter is being recorded, so there's no need to ask for that. I would ask the parties who were participating today, particularly those who may be on the telephone, to please speak up and speak clearly so that we want to ensure that our microphones catch everything. Finally, parties are limited to 10 minutes of legal argument per side, exclusive of questioning by the commissioners, and I will keep track of the time.
Okay, thank you. I just want to identify, is anyone here for the City of Stamford?
Yes, Attorney Weinstock on the phone.
Okay.
Mr. Weinstock,
can you turn up the volume
on that? We'll try.
And then?
Speak up.
Is it Matthew Olson?
Yes, so I'm Mario Cerami. For the record, that's C-E-R-A-M, like Michael E. For Mr. Olson, the respondent.
You're an attorney?
I am. I'm an attorney. You're admitted to the state.
Hello. Great. Well, I'm glad you're in the same boat as I am. I think I heard it come back.
Can you hear us?
Are we back on?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, we were just.
Are you back on, Jim? Yes, I am.
Yeah. Okay, turn it up a little bit.
Deshi and I'm back on.
One more. Good. Okay, Attorney Weinstock, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and Attorney Fuseschi, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, and Attorney Mario
Cerami.
Cerami has just identified himself as counsel for Matthew Olson. All right, so Attorney Cerami, would you like to begin?
Sure. So I want to say, first off, I appreciate the opportunity. I've never come before this forum before. I've argued plenty across the street, but I've never argued before the commission before. So I apologize if I'm not familiar with some of the nuances of practice here, and I appreciate any corrections along that vein. Also, I just want to say I came into this case very late, in a case that was originally my client was pro se, and I didn't have as much time as I would like to have had for a case this complicated and with such novel issues coming before the commission and coming to me. I wasn't aware of this new B5 here at all before my client came to me. Last week I had an extremely difficult briefing schedule, so I recognize the time limit, so I appreciate the accommodation, but I do wish I had more time. I just want to note that for the record. So as to that, As I went through this very detailed, very complicated opinion, I did have several points upon which I had some serious concern. My main area of practice, I would say, I do a lot of complex litigation in order to make the firm run where I work, but I mostly do First Amendment free speech type issues. That's where my passion is, and that's where a lot of my time in work and outside of work is spent. And so along that vein, I think my biggest concern constitutionally with what I see here is viewpoint discrimination. I see a lot of evidence of that and concerns along that vein. I also see concerns of the statute being applied either interpreted, it's either interpreted improperly or interpreted in a, or it's vague on its face. And I'm concerned about that because of the speech implications vis-a-vis the construction of the statute that was applied in this case. And third, I have some concerns about, at the end of the lengthy opinion, the commissioner, the hearing officer makes some findings and links those certain factual findings to conclusions. And there's sometimes a gap between, I don't understand how, or it's not clear from the opinion, how certain facts link up to certain conclusions. And that gap is a concern. There are some other concerns, but those I think are the three main piles. And I think I just want to start and happily, or as a matter of happenstance, there's five provisions in the statute we're looking at here, A, B, C, D, E, under B5, and the three piles tend to orient around one of these or more of these factors that were before the hearing officer in his rendering his recommendation. So, I actually want to start with the, I'm going to start with the viewpoint discrimination concern I have. So just as to, and if we could start, I'm going to start at bound paragraph 133. There's a summary disposition of the free speech claims. And I went back and I did some, looking at some other pieces. But there, the hearing officer recommends, look, there's no free speech concerns here. You don't get a free, you don't get some freewheeling license to say whatever you want through these freedom of information requests. A principal issue is, if someone makes a statement that's critical of the government, that's protected speech. It has to fall in a speech exception to deny someone a civil right based on their speech. There's none of those here. Traditional speech exceptions might be, it's a threat, true threat, it's obscenity, these kinds of things. There's none of those are even colorably here. A reasonable time, place, manner restriction gets around a viewpoint discrimination, but that would be something like, you can't say that here. You can't say that in this form. I can't get up and start swearing, using a bunch of swear words in this form here. You could permissibly tell me not to do that, right? Even if I'm being critical of the government. But here, what we have is we have a bunch of statements that were not made in a forum, that were not made before the commissioner, public statements, criticisms that were written, some of which were, the gentleman's very agitated. You know, my client was very angry and very critical, sometimes searingly so, of government actors. And this is being used, this language is being used in the opinion at numerous points in order to justify denying him the civil right to request information from the government. I don't know if I need to get into the fact that this is a vested right. This is a vested property right. The government has to give you a thing under the statute. So it's not a privilege like driving or something like that. This is a vested property right in individuals given by way of statute. So to deny them this right is going to invoke the First Amendment as denying them a liberty interest or property interest. So in some of the language, so paragraph 133 denies it on its face, but paragraph 40, which is on page 11 in the opinion, you see some of these examples, like the fact that my client called the police a criminal enterprise was called, appropriately, was called hyperbolic by the hearing officer. But hyperbole is per se protected by the First Amendment. People are allowed to be hyperbolic. People are allowed to use colorful, extremely colorful kinds of language in criticizing the government. And here, this is now a basis in this opinion here. And a number of the statements you can see in paragraph 40, the city engaged in criminal activity, the city's acting illegally, these might not be true, but it's a belief he has. It's an opinion he has. And he's trying to find out information about the city's conduct. And so for him, there's no allegation that these statements are unprotected in some way. That's not in the opinion anywhere. But these statements are being used against him to deny him the civil right. We would imagine, for example, quite readily, that if he said something nice about the city, that these wouldn't be used against him. If he said, you know, I want to make sure the city is, I know that they're very responsible. I just want to see, make sure they're as responsible as they possibly can be. Or, you know, I'm very happy with the police. Later on, he says in the opinion, it's used against him that he says, I want to see how I'm eager to see how many times you violated the Fourth Amendment. I'm paraphrasing slightly. But he was concerned about violations of the Fourth Amendment. If he said instead, you know, I want to look at how you have honored the Fourth Amendment in these different contexts, we don't imagine that would be used against him. But because he uses speech as viewpoint that is critical of the government, that is being used to deny him a civil right, that's not okay. Speech that could be used against him would be something like, I'm going to jam up your systems, or I'm going to bury you so deep in FOI requests, your mom's going to weep, or something extreme like that. And we can imagine that there are people who would abuse the system like that and say things like that. That is an opinion that is being used to describe someone's conduct. It's not a viewpoint. It's not expressing an idea. It's describing conduct that someone's going to engage in the same way, for example, speech that's saying, I'm going to go and we're going to go, let's go rob this store, is not protected. So saying, I'm going to bury you in so many requests, that wouldn't be protected. But these statements here, these are statements that no one, not in a public forum, or not, I'm sorry, not in some quasi-public forum like I'm here today. These weren't made in court. These are written statements to the government. And he's angry. And so that's a piece. So just in summary, I see a number of concerns, because I know I only have 10 minutes. I have a number of concerns in this opinion vis-a-vis, and for paragraph 41 gets right to this, puts it right on there. It is found that the content and tone of the content, which is per se also not allowed, you can't do content discrimination. Content, tone, emails referred to in paragraph 40 above were angry, belligerent, and accusatory. Okay. Does that evince an intent? Now, someone can be angry, accusatory, belligerent, rude, and still have a legit request. They're not incompatible with one another. One doesn't budge the other. So this gets into the second issue about vagueness. I was a little bit concerned. For example, there's an opinion out there called State versus Indrizano. It's well known among some criminal defense lawyers as the statute, it's 228 con 795. This is an opinion that narrows a facially vague statute, our disorderly conduct statute in Connecticut. And particularly it deals with the words annoying. And it says that the word annoying is way too broad on its face. And one of the ways that they save the statute for being unconstitutional is they say you have to have a predominant intent to act other than in furtherance of your rights. Your constitutional rights. And there's no finding of that here. There's a finding that there was an intent to act with in a vexatious manner. We'll get to that word in a minute. A finding of an intent to act in some mean-spirited, bad faith way seems to be something percolating in the opinion. I can have that. I can be angry, lawfully be angry, and still be entitled to information. Right? A number of the requests here. Just to back that up a little bit. So the constitutional piece, the constitutional question about the constitutional question about viewpoint discrimination, that's really about section C and D of the statute, okay? So we're talking about nature, content, language, subject matter of the requests, nature, content, subject matter, or other oral written communications to the agency and the requester. This was used by the hearing officer. My problem is it was used by the hearing officer without an adherence to basic constitutional principles vis-a-vis the First Amendment, freedom of speech, and particularly also in our state, sections 4 and 5, state constitution. Section 14 of the state constitution protects the right to remonstrance. And just so we all know, remonstrance is, even if you go back to 1828, you know, Webster's dictionary definition, how much time do I have left?
You're right at 10 minutes now.
Yeah. So may I ask for another, if I could ask for 5 more minutes, is that permissible?
Sure.
I appreciate that. Sure. So I'll summarize my other two pieces in a moment, but remonstrance historically were really scathing criticisms, right? There was once a riot in England historically, if you look at the remonstrance, I think it was in the late 1600s. For us too in America, remonstrance is not, they're not polite words. They're really serious, severe, scathing criticisms. And that's protected under our state constitution separately from the federal. So I have serious concerns about viewpoint discrimination here and constraining my client's speech outside of where it's protected. Okay. Secondarily, the vagueness as applied or facially vagueness concern. I think the statute's either being construed too loose or the statute's vague on its face and it's not okay. This is a quasi-criminal statute being used to punish someone, deny them a civil right. It has implications to speech, so we look at it with more scrutiny than usual. Under Indrizano, I cited the case. That's an example where our court enunciates that, our Supreme Court enunciates that principle. Here, the hearing officer found the word implied into the statute, the words badger. He said this on page 12 in the opinion. To badger and retaliate was an intent that was here. And the word badger is not really, it's not capable of definite meaning. That's a vagueness problem. When something doesn't have a core sanctionable conduct, doesn't have a core meaning to it, the statute here, you know, vexatious is the meaning. You guys use the Merriam-Webster dictionary definition, which includes essentially don't be annoying. Don't harass. You don't use the criminal use of the word harass. You use the dictionary definition. Okay. And also don't cause distress. I have to say that, you know, any large request is probably going to cause someone distress. So the dictionary definition can't be alone enough. It's going to encompass any kind of annoying, frustrating request. That can't be enough to be vexatious. It has to be something something more narrow, or you're going to run afoul of vagueness principles. Distress is too broad. Harass, too broad. There's no core conduct. I might say something's harassing, and you might disagree with me, and you might say something's harassing, and reasonable minds can easily disagree on that, particularly as this is a quasi-criminal statute being used to deprive someone of a property right. You're going to use it, and because it implicates speech issues, you have to look at the statute with a more narrow eye. You have to construe it more narrowly. Okay. So I would be concerned about, you know, if this is how the commission is going to use the statute in the future, I may be here more often. I'd be concerned about that. And that was as to E, right? I'm talking about here, E, section E of the statute, subsection E, a pattern of conduct that amounts to an abuse of the right. That's not self-defining. What is an abuse of the right? And we interpolate to that the vexatious piece. To be vexatious is to be abusive of the right. And he didn't use the, you know, vexatious litigation. There's nothing frivolous here, too, I should say, along this vein, too. If you said vexatious means frivolous, for example, that's something that's constrained. It's a term of art people understand in the law, and it's fixed. But you didn't say that. You used a common sense dictionary definition. Okay. But that's very sweeping and can be used in to cause all manner of mischief. So none of the things my client did were held to be frivolous. None of his requests were held to be frivolous. The number of requests were not held in the opinion itself, since this is on its own, isn't so many, 30-something over several years. It amounted to something like 1.2, 1.16 per month. That's not an egregious amount. The things he was requesting, for example, like every use of the disorderly conduct statute.
What do you base that on at one point? Even just one a month isn't excessive. What do you base that on? Is that just common sense? Is that what you're saying?
It doesn't seem that crazy. I have submitted that many when I was interning, for example, at a public interest group. We submitted far more than that.
And he's part of a public interest group?
No, but I don't know that that's to be used against him. I don't know that fairly the statute allows discrimination against an individual as to whether he's, or there's some overarching reasonableness as to that.
You're the one who raised the fact that one point, whatever it was per month, wasn't excessive. And I'm just curious for your basis for that.
Sure. I think that a number that truly interferes with the there's no evidence that it genuinely interfered, that many, right? Now, if there was evidence put forward in the record, look, there's no way this municipality, Stamford, can handle one per month. If there was, or 1.2 per month. If there was evidence in the record as to that, maybe we're on to something here. I don't think there was. Now, granted, this is a 33-page opinion. There's some extensive facts in the middle here. And I might be wrong as to that. But it does cause one pause, I think, Attorney Einhorn, to say that one a month is too many, or 1.2 a month is too many. So, especially if they're not frivolous, right? So that's a, you know, that's one of the factors that the panel can consider, the commission can consider, the hearing officer can consider, and the panel can consider, is the number. And there's no evidence that that's excessive. Now, there are people who, there are legitimate bad actors out there who I'm sure try to bury people in paperwork and try to do things like staple papers, use too many staples, or do things to try to just make the government's life more difficult, not to get information. But that's not the evidence here. I have someone who's upset, but he was worried he was being racially profiled. And that's why he was upset. And then he felt like, you know, sometimes ordinary people come into a situation, they don't necessarily understand the process, and they feel like everybody's against them. That's not crazy. It's unfortunate, but it's not crazy. And the number of requests, nothing he did was he didn't violate any rule of politeness. There's no politeness rule out there for how these things have to be drafted. I'm not sure one would be constitutional if there was. But this, you know, so I'm not sure how that, the number of requests, that's the A, doesn't seem to be unreasonable. B, the scope of the requests, I have asked for these kinds of things, and I still do. I'm litigating 5337 and its applications, and I'm asking for this information from the whole judicial branch, from every state prosecutor, right? How was that statute employed? And one of the things he asked for, how did Stanford use the disorderly conduct statute? I've done that in my research myself. That's not crazy to ask for in terms of scope. So I know I'm over time, and so I welcome any questions the commission may have, particularly Attorney Einhorn, your questions well taken.
I would just say, this is Commissioner Hankins, I would just say that the other side get as much time as respondents counsel.
I hope so.
We're at 19 minutes.
19 minutes. Okay. Counsel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Will you just identify yourself again, please?
Certainly. This is Attorney Kenneth Weinstock for the City of Stanford.
Okay.
Preliminarily, I apologize for participating by phone. Unfortunately, I was diagnosed with COVID yesterday, so I didn't think that any of you would appreciate my being present at the commission in order to make this argument. So,
thank you.
Hopefully, this isn't too much of an inconvenience for people. So, I will do my best to communicate this as well as I can. For the most part, the City of Stanford would urge the commission to adopt the hearing officer's proposed final decision as written, in a very broad way of looking at it. The city is of the belief that the hearing officer's decision completely complies with the provisions of 1-206B5. And the city takes no issue with those findings. So I will attempt to address some of the issues that Attorney Cerami raised in his argument. And while the First Amendment discussion is very interesting, and I am by no means either a First Amendment scholar, nor do I even attempt to practice in the field, I would also say that the Freedom of Information Commission is not the forum where issues related to First Amendment would be appropriately raised. The commission's job is to interpret and apply the statute as written. And presumably, when the legislature adopted 1-206B5, they understood the precepts of statutory construction is that they understood what the other limitations in the law and the Constitution were in adopting this provision. And so it's presumed to be appropriate, constitutional, and binding until such time as a court has said otherwise. Not really for the commission to make a determination either whether the statute is vague or whether or not the statute's ability to limit under D, the content, nature, language, or subject matter of the oral and written communications to the agency from the requester, not for the commission to make a determination whether that provision of the statute is or is not constitutional, whether it does or does not comply with the First Amendment. I would suggest that it does from what I know. And in fact, you know, Mr. Olson, in his own brief, said many things that I don't agree with, but what he did say on page 4 of his brief, which I do agree with, he said, quote, the commission simply has no jurisdiction to ascertain whether speech is protected or not. And I completely agree with him. That is simply not the commission's jurisdiction. The commission's jurisdiction is to apply the statute. Furthermore, and unless and until the 1-206B5 and C or D is declared to be unconstitutional, I would argue that the statute as written should be applied and must be applied by the Freedom of Information Commission, and that it's presumed to be constitutional until such time as a court has stated otherwise. And to date, there has been no court determination saying otherwise. So the statute, as it reads currently, was applied by the hearing officer. City would suggest that it was applied correctly by the hearing officer, and that the commission has no jurisdiction to determine whether or not that application does or does not rise to the level of a First Amendment violation. Something else is that despite what I heard from counsel, there are plenty of conduct statements that the respondent made in his various requests, which the hearing officer highlighted quite well, either statements of abuse to the public officials and employees to whom he was making requests, threatening to bring grievances against them, you know, alluding to the fact that his mother-in-law was an attorney for the Department of Justice. You know, those are things that obviously infer conduct, i.e., I will bring some type of claim against you, and that those were made in conjunction with and oftentimes in the same communication in which he was making the FOI requests. So as the hearing officer, the city correctly, believes correctly found, those things couldn't easily be divorced from the underlying request, that the nature and content and language used in those communications that accompanies the request did rise to the level of violations of the statute. Something else that I would point out is that, you know, from what I heard of counsel's argument that certain terms and things are too vague, such as badger or harass, or things of that nature, I would draw the commission's attention to the Masacci, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but the Masacci case, which is cited in the hearing officer's decision. There's both a federal district court decision and a state court decision related to Mr. Masacci. And what's interesting is the reason why I would draw your attention to that. The federal district court case made it very clear in finding that there's no First Amendment right to harass or abuse a public official as it related to freedom of information requests or appeals. The court did not more clearly define in Masacci what harass or abuse is, and there was no appeal to any of those court determinations challenging the vagueness or the overly broad conclusion that the court reached in terms of saying that an individual does not have a First Amendment right to harass or abuse. And so, you know, given counsel's argument that that the conclusions of the hearing officer, the findings of the hearing officer, that certain types of conduct were too vague to really have application, and that standing alone, they were too broad. I believe he said that harass and badger were too broad to really have application. Those are the exact same findings that an esteemed federal district court judge and our state court And so without carrying on any further, I would just suggest again that the commission adopt the hearing officer's findings and his conclusions. We believe that when applying the very clear language of the statute as the hearing officer did, when applying that and looking at the facts and the evidence in the case, that it's very clear that this is exactly why the legislature adopted, in particular, from paragraph D of 1-206B5, is to address just this very type of conduct, which is frankly a little different from the God-bound conduct in the very first vexatious requester decision by the commission, that this is exactly what the legislature intended by putting in subparagraph D into 1-206B5. And that it's for exactly the reasons that Stanford experienced, that on the one hand, we have diligent public servants who are attempting to provide the information that individuals request, but in the process of doing that, they should not have to face either complaints, grievances, criticisms in conjunction with those very same requests. They need not be reminded of their legal obligations and duties, nor have to be facing threats of litigation or other types of retribution if they don't do what the requester has asked them to do. And I would submit that that's exactly what occurred here, and that that's exactly what the legislature intended when it sought under 206B5 to give the commission the ability to look at the nature and content of the written communications related to those requests. And, Stanford did its best here, but clearly there were many of those threats or harassing statements, and we would submit that the hearing officer reached the correct conclusion. You should adopt the decision as written, and I'm happy to take questions.
Do any of the commissioners have any questions?
No.
Counsel, would you like to respond?
I have two.
Just identify yourself for the record.
Very good, of course. This is Attorney Mario Cerami once again for the respondent, Mr. Olson. So I have two pieces. I think that speech that is reminding public officials of their obligations. I heard counsel say that there's no need to remind them of their legal obligations. That kind of speech is not protected in an FOI context. First off, some of the speech, a great deal of the speech for which my client is being punished here, came outside of the FOI request context. It was about dialogue he had with the agencies generally. And so I don't understand how the commission has jurisdiction over those statements and to use those statements against my client. I understand that the statute gives them the right to look at the communications. But if the communications are perfectly protected conduct, perfectly protected speech, and they're using it against my client, that seems to be patently unconstitutional to me. Second, I heard counsel use the word threat. And threat is a special word in the First Amendment. For speech to be unprotected, it has to be what's called a true threat. There's no allegation of that here, and I don't think counsel's going to fight that point. So this is criticism of government agencies that's being used to deny someone a property right, as applied here, by using this statute as applied to the facts of this case. I'm encouraging you to reject the findings of the commissioner vis-a-vis this. So if there are any other further questions, I'm happy to elaborate on any of these points.
Thank you. Do the commissioners have any questions?
No, thank you. I do have comments.
Go ahead.
All right, as hearing officer, I'm going to go beyond the arguments of counsel in the event that, other matters might be brought up on appeal later if there is, in fact, an appeal. And because these issues, were brought up in the briefs of the parties. And I'm really just going to concentrate on the application of the law, the facts in the case, the duty that the Freedom of Information Commission is charged with under the statute. The respondent is the most vexatious requester that I've seen since my time on the commission, as well as my experience when I first served at handling freedom of information matters for both complainants and respondents going back to 1988. I want to make it very clear that the findings in this proposed decision are based on the respondent's behavior and conduct as set forth in many, in his words, as set forth in many of the exhibits that the respondent himself has written, as well as through the testimony of the complainant's witnesses. In my proposed decision, I go no further than this evidence in reaching my findings and proposed conclusions. Throughout the entire proceedings, the respondent's conduct and behavior sought to accomplish three objectives. The first objective was to weaponize the Freedom of Information Act to attack, insult, vex, harass, demean, and threaten the employees of the city of Stamford, as well as one of their witnesses in another Freedom of Information proceeding, Attorney Atkins. The respondent also weaponized the Freedom of Information Act against the Freedom of Information Commission staff, its commissioners, and myself as designated hearing officer. The second objective was to delay and obstruct these proceedings so as to go beyond its one-year lifespan in order for the complainant to yet again reinstitute a PRVR proceeding. The third objective was to create as much havoc and turmoil by spreading as many lies and strange diatribes as he could. A clear example of this is the respondent's claim that he was being discriminated against because of his claimed Mexican or Hispanic heritage. There's not one iota of evidence of this allegation being even remotely true. The only hint of racism was from the respondent, and he falsely claimed that a rich white woman was complaining about his car being improperly parked. In this matter, both substantive due process and procedural due process have been met. In terms of substantive due process, it's well settled that a government can put limits on speech. It is well within Connecticut's authority to enact 1-206B5 and well within its authority to charge the Freedom of Information Commission with the responsibility of enforcing this provision. This statute clearly and carefully sets forth the parameters in which to judge whether an individual is a vexatious requester. The statute authorizes the executive director of the Freedom of Information Commission to make the initial determination on whether to initiate proceedings pursuant to the statute, which was done in this instant matter. From his emails and various motions prior to the first hearing, it is clear that the respondent was aware of the parameters of 1-206 (b)(5). He had read PRVR number one, had composed and contrasted his behavior to that of the respondent in PRVR number one, and had filed a request to define the term threat. As hearing officer, I defined the term threat and also defined other terms that would be used in the instant matter. In terms of procedural due process, and again, this was, brought up by both parties, both during the proceedings and their briefs. The requirements of procedural due process were more than met for the respondent as set forth in the decision. Before and during these proceedings, the respondent stated in writing and orally that he was not inclined to participate in the proceedings. Throughout the proceedings, the respondent gave many notices of his non-appearance at scheduled hearings. Throughout the proceedings, the respondent filed many requests to postpone. He would also state that he would cooperate and participate in a new PRVR should PRVR number four be withdrawn or dismissed without prejudice, and that I be replaced as the hearing officer. Almost all of the respondent's many motions to postpone were granted. And three out of the four hearings in this matter, the proceedings were terminated because of the respondent. At the fourth and last hearing of October 13th, the respondent abandoned the proceedings in a fit of pique without informing me or the staff because of an imaginary insult. The respondent left knowing that this was the last day of the proceedings. That's paragraph 12 of the decision. At the third hearing of August 9th, 22, the respondent terminated the proceedings claiming that he was the only individual not being compensated for participating, and they had two other business meetings scheduled that he had to attend. The first hearing on 4/20/22 was terminated early because of the respondent's disingenuous claim that he did not have the proposed exhibits. This claim was not true and was intended to delay the proceedings. The respondent's claim for not having these documents or being unable to obtain them is not true because of four reasons. First, all of the complainant's exhibits were emails that the respondent had sent. Therefore, the respondent had them in his possession. Second, the respondent had already received most, if not all, of the emails he had sent that were to be put in as exhibits by way of attachments to PVR numbers 3 and 4. Third, the respondent lied when he said that he threw away these proposed exhibits, which is again the emails that he sent. Respondent's statement that he threw the documents away was not true because he changed his story during this hearing and said that he had these documents in storage. Last, the respondent's claim that he was afraid of obtaining the proposed exhibits from the complainant's attorney because of a claimed computer virus from the complainant's attorney was also a false narrative meant to obstruct and delay. The respondent is an IT professional, owns an IT small business, and told everyone at the hearing that he had more knowledge about computers than anyone at the hearing. It is not a chasm-like jump in logic to assume that the respondent would have easily surmounted this make-believe virus, especially since in an email dated November 10th, 2020, from the respondent to one of Stanford's employees, the respondent states that the computer virus from attorney Weinstock can be easily preventable with basic IT security. That's Exhibit B at page 5.2. To protect the due process rights of the respondent, no evidence was taken at the first hearing. The complainant's attorney volunteered to Federal Express hard copies of the proposed exhibits, and this was so ordered. The respondent, I used the delta, so I interchanged the respondent's claim of no witnesses. You know, the respondent's claim that he was not able to call witnesses is fanciful and without merit. The original transmittal documents for the April 20th hearing, the first hearing, set forth the requirements for both parties to disclose their witnesses who were to testify. At the third hearing on August 9th, in answer to the questions from the respondent, I informed him that he could come up with a list of witnesses, and if the complainant's attorney would not voluntarily have them appear to testify, that I would subpoena them to testify. That's paragraph 104 of the decision. There were a number of subsequent notices, again informing the parties of the necessity of identifying their respective witnesses. The last such notice was dated 9/12, which ordered the parties to appear at the last hearing date of 10/13 with all their remaining direct testimony by affidavit. That's paragraphs 8 and 99. The respondent never complied with any order to disclose. Despite this, on October 11th and October 12th, the respondent filed two motions to subpoena witnesses for the 10/13 final hearing. These motions were denied as untimely, as paragraphs 102 and 103. Because the respondent consistently ignored the several orders to disclose his witnesses, he's condemned by his freedom of choice. The respondent's attempt to reconvene the hearing, that's at paragraphs 109 through 114. At the fourth and final hearing in this matter, after yet another one of his motions to postpone was denied, the respondent showed up, and instead of cross-examining the complainant's remaining witness, he chose instead to argue his third motion to dismiss, as well as an oral motion to recuse that he had just brought up that day. For 45 minutes, the respondent spoke on these motions, arguing, amongst other things, that I was insane. He mentioned it three times, and that I should apologize to him, which he also mentioned three times. In further support of these motions, the respondent stated that I was a liar because I held myself out as being employed at the Connecticut Education Association as an attorney. The respondent mistakenly based his assertion on an article that was written about me in 2013 when I did represent the Connecticut Education Association as its legal counsel. This article is on the Freedom of Information Commission's website under the Meet the Commissioners section, and it is an old article that the respondent in his blind anger, somehow convinced himself that it was a current article. And, you know, this would be like currently calling Barack Obama a liar because of a 2013 article written about him being the president. After about 1 hour, the respondent requested a recess to use the bathroom. During this recess, he took the opportunity to abandon the proceedings without informing me or the FOIC staff. Because he voluntarily abandoned the proceedings, which was later found out to be due to an imaginary insult he claimed he suffered, he has no legitimate cause to complain. Another aspect of procedural due process were the motions and memoranda filed by the respondent. Another exercise of his due process rights is that he filed a large and varied number of motions, memorandums, and requests, as noted in the proposed decision. There was a motion to define threat, motions to suppress evidence, motion to dismiss, request to postpone, a request to reconvene, a request to recuse, and other such motions. These many motions and requests were all ruled upon. During the course of these proceedings, the respondent also kept in communication with the FOIC staff and some commissioners. Sometimes he copied the complainant's attorney, other times he communicated ex parte, although the respondent was aware that he should not have done this. And that goes back to some conversations the parties had and we had at the first hearing. The respondent, as well as the complainant, were allowed to take a break whenever it was requested. A request for a break was never refused. Further, as the hearing officer at each inflection point in a hearing, I would ask the parties if they wanted a recess. The entire record of the proceedings, including its audio tape, will show that as the hearing officer, I was patient and even-handed. I informed the parties that I wanted to make sure to preserve the record in the event of an appeal, like I'm doing now, and I made many allowances for the respondent since he was pro se. This allowance was sometimes to the detriment of the due process rights of the complainant, such as when I permitted the respondent to file an addendum to his post-hearing brief over the objection of the complainant. Another such ruling was made by the commission over the objection of the complainant was to postpone the disposition of the proposed decision until today, and a special meeting convened solely for this purpose on the day before a major holiday. Now, this was a last-minute request to postpone on behalf of the respondent, and is granting further demonstrates safeguarding of the due process rights of the respondent. Also, the respondent put forth no sworn testimony and no probative evidence. And for all of that, due process was in fact met. Turning to the complainant meeting its burden, the respondent's FOI requests, related conduct, and communications, you know, I want to make it very clear that the respondent's interactions with the city of Stamford, its employees and agents alone, set forth in paragraphs 15 through 71, justify the determination that the respondent is a vexatious requester under 1-206B5. The respondent has more than met, I'm sorry, the plaintiff, I'm gonna use the profit sign, the complainant has more than met its burden in this regard. It is evident that those paragraphs show that the respondent weaponized the Freedom of Information Act to vex, harass, threaten, badger, retaliate, and insult individuals employed and associated with the city of Stamford the past 2.5 years. The respondent first started his unhinged tirade with members of the Stamford Police Department, worked his way through various city employees, and then settled on the city's attorneys, its hired expert, and the legal counsel hired to represent Stamford. The respondent made bizarre, hyperbolic, and or false claims against the Stamford Police Department, including that his son was physically assaulted. That's paragraph 22B. A rich white woman reported his car is illegally parked. That's 26C. That it violated federal law, that it was blatantly discriminatory. That's paragraph 33. And it was a criminal enterprise engaged in criminal activity. That's paragraph 40. The respondent vexed, harassed, and threatened other employees of the city of Stamford. I don't know if this is in the my decision or not, but you know, I set forth in paragraph 17 of the complainant's
1020 post-hearing brief at paragraph 33 to 35 of Attorney Emmett's deposition testimony, when Sandra Denny's, Stanford's director of administration, did not answer the respondent's questions, which is not required under the Freedom of Information Act, he accused her of discrimination and obliquely threatened her with bringing criminal charges against her if she did not comply with the request. The respondent harassed, taunted, threatened Stanford's legal department with his weaponized FOI requests. At various times, the respondent called the Stanford attorneys, as well as outside legal counsel, unspeakable racists, falsely claiming that they had committed crimes, and threatened to report them to the grievance committee, the CHRO, and the attorney general for criminal prosecution. An example of the harassing and vexatious nature of the respondent was testified to by Attorney Toma at a hearing and reported and recounted by both parties in their post-hearing briefs. Well, at a prior hearing at Trinity Street, the respondent followed Attorney Toma into the bathroom where the respondent insulted and berated him. The takeaway from this is that the respondent offensively regales us in his addendum brief with how long it takes the average male to urinate. And something that I've not seen before, the respondent went after one of Stanford's expert witnesses and Attorney Atkins. The respondent FOI'd his information with Stanford's legal department and even went on the law firm's website of Attorney Atkins to leave a defamatory Google business profile review stating their legal ethicist, David Atkins, is a common thief. That's paragraph 61 through 64. And of the proposed decision at paragraphs 49 through 51 of Attorney Emmett's testimony. For the last 7 months or so, the respondent loosed his vexatious fury against the Freedom of Information Commission, its staff, executive director, commissioners, and myself as the designated hearing officer. The respondent's unhinged tirades against the commission and its employees are set forth in paragraph 72 to 114, and you've read them. It's kind of a case of res ipsa locator. Just as an example, amongst the things the respondent called me are discriminatory, dishonest, corrupt, biased, incompetent, a monster, insane, full of hate. This one I don't understand. Six, and then he says 8 years unemployed. I don't know how that's meant to be an insult. The respondent also went outside the Freedom of Information Commission and told all of Connecticut senators and representatives that I was a quote, literal, a piece of dog shit, close quote. I think that last one jumps the Sullivan New York Times hurdle. In many of his rants, the respondent had a ready, fire, aim approach. An example of this, I don't think it's in the proposed decision, occurred with attorney Amy Lavosi, who is a former Freedom of Information Commissioner. But any proof whatsoever, the respondent proclaimed that attorney Lavosi, who is now associated with the city of Stanford, held sway and influence the commissioners at the Freedom of Information Commission. The actual truth of the matter is attorney Lavosi was a commissioner of the commission who resigned. She became an attorney with the city of Stanford in some capacity. She waited the statutory time period before appearing in front of the commission. And then in the two cases that she did represent the city of Stanford before the commission, the city of Stanford did not prevail. And what this demonstrates is that Attorney Lavosi did not hold any particular sway with the commission, and that the respondent's assertions are totally false, misguided, reckless, and without merit. Paragraphs 115 through 137 of the decision. It's the application of a lot of the facts. Applying the, a lot of the facts found was not a difficult issue. As per these paragraphs, the respondent was found to be a vexatious requester pursuant to the statute. Therefore, it's concluded that the and it need not comply with any FOI request for a period of 1 year from the city of Stamford. And, you know, this is an application of Mazat. You know, this at paragraph 137. And I would be happy to try to answer any of the questions the commissioner has mentioned.
Thank you, Commissioner Hankins.
Yeah.
Does anybody have any questions for Commissioner Hankins?
I have just a comment that, you know, I think that, you know, the hearing officer was very thorough, well-reasoned, and explained the decision. Commissioner Hankins has been a long-standing hearing officer, and as the trier of facts in this case, distilled the facts and properly applied the statutes to the decision. I think that, obviously, the length of it, we've had longer ones, but this was probably one of the better reads as far as getting to the facts and lining up the statute with it. So I'd be in favor of the hearing officer's report as written.
I'd like to...
Mr. Chairman,
hold on a second. Hold on a second.
Sure.
Do any commissioners have any other comments?
Well, I just wanted to note that all of us know that just abusive and disrespectful speech itself can be protected speech under the First Amendment. But that's not the case here. This respondent, to use a Hollywood metaphor, jumped the shark. I mean, the respondent's conduct is as offensive conduct as I think I've ever heard in 40 some odd years of practice of law before any administrative body or court or even human beings. And even forgetting for a moment the insults to Commissioner Henkin, his conduct with regard to the, to the city of Stamford and victims unnecessarily castigated, such as Attorney Atkins, I think is as was well written, clearly falls within the purview of the statute. I would support the hearing officer's recommendation, and I agree it's extraordinarily well written, very patient, and extremely detailed as setting forth the record of exactly what transpired here and exactly what the basis is. Should we agree to approve it, which I will do.
I also agree. I think Commissioner Hankins did an excellent job drafting the decision. I think he was extremely patient with all the parties, including Mr. Olson. He did an excellent job today here describing the details of which went into his decision-making process, and I am also going to support his decision.
Yes, this is Commissioner Fusashi. I just want to note that I will also support the decision. And in response, just I would note, with reference to paragraph 40, about which there was some argument, an argument was made, that I read paragraph 40 in the context, and all pieces of it, paragraph 40, in the context of the whole hearing officer's report, not in isolation. So, I will also be voting in favor of the hearing officer's report.
Thank you, Commissioner Fusashi.
I'd like to preserve a matter for the record, just put it in the record quickly, if that's possible, if that's allowed, or I'll submit something in writing afterwards.
Speaking of your discretion.
Sure. No, so this, go ahead. So I note that this was an...
Identify yourself. Please.
Thank you. You're absolutely right, Commissioner. Mario Cerami, C-E-R-A-M-E, for Mr. Olson. I just want to note this was an extensive and very important presentation by the hearing officer.
How long is this?
About 3 minutes, and you're welcome to time me.
Thank you. That's fine.
It's truly with the intent to preserve. I would note that I didn't have notice of what Commissioner Hankins was going to say, what the hearing officer was going to say. A lot of this was new information that wasn't presented to me and wasn't actually, as he said in his own words, was not in his report. And so I'm noting under, for example, Haynes versus Middletown, 314 Con 303, 2014, I didn't have sufficient notice of the arguments that were going to be made today. I didn't have the ability to rebut rebut what was said by the hearing officer. So I would ask for that opportunity. I see that the vote has already been.
I think that the commission was in deliberation. You know, his comments were to, you know, help the commission. I don't think that this was something that needs to be provided to the respondents or the complainants.
This is Commissioner Hankins.
Yes, Commissioner Hankins.
That was Commissioner Streeter.
All of my comments are in the record. They're on the record. They're in the 584 pages of documents. They're on the audio tapes of four hearings. You know, that's kind of what I said in the preamble. And, you know, it's the respondent's attorney got in late in the game, like 3 minutes before midnight. So, yeah, maybe a lot of this caught him by surprise. I'm sure he was surprised by reading the decision, you know, the proposed decision. I'm sure he hasn't looked at all the exhibits, and I'm probably sure that he hasn't listened to all the audio tapes. So some of this is going to, you know, this is not out on the record. I stay on the record. You know, I've been an attorney since 1984. I know how to stay on the record. You know, nothing. I mean, I don't want to tell you what I know outside of the record, you know. But, you know, there are ex parte communications that were sent to me and to the commission also. I don't know if the complainant's attorney actually has those either, you know. But that is part of the record, and that's what I said at the last hearing. I said that we are going to put in all the communications of emails that were sent to the commission and everybody. So that's part of the record also. So nothing that I said today is outside of the record.
Okay, so just to, this is Attorney Cerami. Once again, I just wanted to clarify, I'd ask for just that time back. I'm actually just trying to preserve, I'm not trying to engender an argument, you've made your vote. So I'm just trying to preserve these issues, my perceptions as I sit here right now, because some other tribunal is going to be looking at these words later on, and I'm going to have to be discussing this point. So as my point being, just to clarify for the record, for the purposes of preservation, I didn't have notice of a number of the particular arguments today. They were not, as the hearing officer said, these went beyond the arguments that were before the commission, or outside of his written opinion. So I didn't have notice of those things. I couldn't, of course, be possibly have notice or the ability to respond to those. So, and I think that that's not okay, kosher under 314 con 303. That was my point. This is an ambush. I had no notice of these supplemental findings, of these supplemental arguments. I also note that it seems that the hearing officer took a number of things personally. He was offended. That Attorney Einhorn, I note that he found offense. And offense is not enough. Offense is never enough for the First Amendment. That's a fundamental principle. I also note that the hearing officer, he must have found something in his opinion inadequate, or else why would he submit such an extensive set of supplemental findings? And there was one point, only one point, I want to clarify vis-a-vis facts. The hearing officer, I think, appropriately called out my client for noting about the average urination man, time of a male. And that was because my client has health issues, and he was explaining the extent of his health issues. And that's the context that came in. That is an example of the kinds of fact-finding that was engaged in here that didn't provide context and was just being used to put my client in the worst possible light, not in a fair way. That's all I needed to note for the record.
Hold on a second. Commissioner Hankins.
I'm sorry, just quickly in response. I take issue with the fact of it being an ambush. You know, you come in 2 days before the response attorney comes in, 2 days before this, we were supposed to do this hearing. On one of the Wednesdays, and what I said early in my preamble was that the respondent's words and conduct alone, all his writings alone against the city of Stamford, are more than sufficient to find him the vexatious requester. So, you know, I think I was careful in saying that. You know, and I think that I am extraordinarily patient when it comes to this, and I think his comments about me and all that was the tip of the iceberg. And I didn't dwell on it, but it may sound magnified when put in isolation. But clearly, it's against just the finding and decision is solely based on what the respondents did against the members of the employees of the city of Stamford and its activities.
Thank you.
Mr. Streeter, I move adoption of the hearing officer's report.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion?
Yes, I just wanted to, just very quickly, note for the record, I did use the word offensive, and I did not say that his speech was offensive. In the history of this country, there's been offensive speech since its founding and continues to be offensive speech. What I said was that, and that alone doesn't constitute a violation of any constitutionally protected laws or conduct. What I said was that his conduct, and my exact words were, his conduct was, the respondent's conduct was as offensive conduct as I'd ever seen. And by offensive conduct, that takes in the magnitude of his vexatious history. And that is the context in which the term offensive was used. But at no time did I say that I was criticizing his offensive speech, which was offensive in any event, but I was referring to his entire, the magnitude of his entire conduct. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn?
Yes.
Commissioner Fugashi?
Yes.
Commissioner Hankins?
Yes.
Commissioner Streeter?
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan, yes. Passes unanimously. Thank you, Council. Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
Motion's been made and seconded. I'll take a roll call of those in favor. Commissioner Einhorn.
Yes.
Mr. Fugashi.
Yes.
Mr. Hankins.
Yes.
Mr. Streeter.
Yes.
And myself, Owen Egan. Yes. Thank you.
Right. Are you Judge Egan?
No. My father was the U.S. magistrate judge.
Yeah. I was mildly confused.
Yeah.
Did I recognize the name?
Yeah.